complete, Great Society was not a complete failure. Parts of it were done poorly. There were things like, say, Head Start, which plainly did exactly what they were supposed to do. Those kids moved ahead. But because they moved back when they were no longer getting special compensatory education programs, until by the time they were in third or fourth grade, you couldn't academically distinguish them from the kids who didn't have Head Start, people said, it's a failure. What a silly conclusion. The right answer is not to stop Head Start or cut it back, which has been done. It's hopefully going to expand again, but to continue it, perhaps throughout 12 years of education. But the cliche that became embedded in the public mind that that program and all the other programs of the Great Society were failures, that, quote, you don't solve problems by throwing money at them, is, in my view, incorrect. We didn't throw it with sufficient accuracy. We didn't throw it with sufficient care, and above all, we didn't throw enough of it. You can look at the programs of the Great Society from model cities to Nixon's revenue sharing, in fact, past the Great Society, and see why they didn't achieve what they were supposed to achieve, and that's because the Congress disbursed the money. Model cities, which was supposed to start out with 14 cities as a demonstration, round up with over 70, which means that no place got enough money to really show what might be done if you put money in with pinpoint accuracy and in sufficient volume. I think it's inherent in the legislative process that I watched all those years as a journalist and watch now as a bureaucrat, that Congress will always want to do that, that it is inherent in the legislative process that Congress will want to put one of everything in every congressional district. And I think it is very hard, close to impossible, to overcome that. But the only way we are going to not stop diffusing the money so widely that it doesn't do anybody any good is going to be if those of us who live in middle class and upper middle class neighborhoods will engage in a great act of altruism, will actually write our congressmen and really work for the concept of pinpointing the money into the areas of need, of overcoming the idea that there should be one of everything in every congressional district, some portion of a program. Maybe even as was done in revenue sharing, they thought they weren't doing too badly when they gave the richest suburbs in the country a smaller proportion of the revenue sharing money than poor places. But even that, I suggest, is a misuse of funds. There was no reason why the wealthiest communities in this country should be building tennis courts with revenue-sharing money when kids in poor neighborhoods have 12-year-old encyclopedias. But I think it will take an enormous act of well-organized altruism to overcome the feeling in Congress that there's got to be one for every district. I'm concerned about a particular program where this is liable to happen next year. Title I of the Education Act, Compensatory Education. This program has been a very significant success. The criterion for who gets Title I money is a purely economic one in the law as it currently exists. And using a pure income test has proved to be about a 95% accurate way of targeting where the money goes. I've been in Title I schools, and it is such a high to see those kids, to see what they're getting. They give kind of a market basket of different things you can buy with Title I money. A lot of places it's paraprofessionals, and you see those warm, affectionate relationships between the one-on-one of the teachers, mostly, though not entirely, black women, and the kids of all races, who are being with that teacher herself, perhaps not too far from non-literacy or not very good literacy, reinforcing what the trained teacher has taught, and you can just watch it succeed and see. Legislation that comes up for renewal next year is that the QI approach, the
He's a moderate Republican, not considered a terrible fellow by anyone. But his approach will be to use a different criterion from the pure economic income test. And that means the money is going to get spread around and diffused. There will be ever so many more eligibles and probably no additional money in absolute dollar terms, so that it will be, the impact will be diffused. And then we will be able in a few years to say Title I is a failure. And you don't solve money problems by throwing money at them. And I suggest that will be a tragedy, but one we all have to work very hard to avert. Sorry.
If anybody has any questions of Ms. Shanahan.
Yes. Yeah, that program was devised in HEW. It's our program, Dr. Karen Davis, the principal deviser. I suppose I would say we are medium optimistic about getting that through. The way this, for those of you who don't know, is a proposal to put a temporary ceiling, not on hospital prices, but on the rate of rise of hospital costs, which under the formula that would work out for this year would be 9% a year, as opposed to 15%, which is what it has been in each of the last several years. The way Congress is set up, that particular legislation has to go through two committees on each side of the Congress, and it has gone through one on each side. Well, okay, and they were, one must admit, what we always knew in advance were the two easy ones. It's still got to go through Rostenkowski's Subcommittee of Ways and Means in the House, which is hard-ish, and Talmadge's Finance Subcommittee in the Senate, which is extremely hard. That's about all I can tell you. There is, we don't feel futile about it. We don't feel extremely optimistic about it. The American people are for that program. There's absolutely no question about it, even though most people don't directly pay their own hospital bill. That's why this thing got out of control in the first place. When you're paying your Blue Cross premium, or in many cases, especially the big unionized corporations, where the company looks like it's paying it. I'm fond of saying that in all my years in economics, I never knew anything that all economists agreed on except one, and that is that something that fringe benefits of that sort are really borne by the employee, that your wages would be higher if the corporation wasn't paying those costs. So we are all really paying those hospital costs. We just don't know it. And but even though people are aware or aren't aware that they're bearing those costs themselves, they are still just absolutely shocked. And I think more and more people are becoming conscious of some of the rip-off aspects of hospitals. This business of making you check in on Friday for surgery that's going to take place on Tuesday, and they don't even begin the tests until Monday. People are starting to balk at that. My own sister is in the hospital this minute with a terrible case of bronchial asthma, and they give her not one but two electrocardiograms when she has no heart history whatever, nor no suspicion of any heart involvement in her case. There are a lot of things. I like to tell journalists where the stories are that they ought to go looking for in their hospitals. Conflicts of interest, the laundry company, laundry supplier being on the board of the hospital, all sorts of stuff like that. Hospitals, non-profit alleged hospitals leaving their money on deposit in banks and getting no interest on them. The Washington Post did a very splendid series on that sort of thing about a year and a half ago. Philadelphia Magazine has one in the works. I'd like to see a lot more than that. I think people are becoming aware And it's just a question of how high a priority they assign to it in terms of making their views known to their elected representatives, I think, as to whether it'll go through or not. Yeah. First of all, I do not speak for Califano or the president on the subject of abortion. I had that agreement before I took the job because I am in disagreement with their position. So I'll explain but not defend or anything, and I don't even like to explain very much. I don't know. I don't see any sign of lobbying. The curious thing about that whole Hyde Amendment controversy, it seems to me, is that it's being treated unlike a normal political issue which calls for compromise. And people, and especially the absolute anti-abortion people in the House, Hyde, and the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Flood of Pennsylvania, are just absolutely rigid and not acting as if it were a normal, compromisable political issue. So that the whole thing is very puzzling, even from just viewing it as a political person will view a legislative process. This is such a weird one. I don't have any sense of where it's going. I saw a pamphlet around here somewhere recently. It said 417 men and 18 women, which is the count in the House, which undoubtedly has something to do with something. I don't know whether, you know, does it get worse? I think the hypocrisy of government employees' own health insurance for middle-class people covering abortion, when at the same time the president is saying that Medicaid can't cover abortion, is something one is nervous about raising for fear they'll take it away from government health insurance, but the hypocrisy of it is quite galling. Yes? Well, the problem with food stamps is that a lot of people, for reasons I'm not sure I understand, won't use them because they feel stigmatized. They don't like to stand in the checkout counter and have people stare at them when they pull out their food stamps, which is understandable to, if you've ever stood in the checkout line behind some poor woman who was had food stamps. I did one time, and the woman behind me said, "Look at her buying cookies with food stamps." And I said, "So poor kid shouldn't get a cookie once in a while?" In any event, food stamps, the eligibility versus use figures you cite are a good bit higher than the national average, but we're well aware that a lot of people who are eligible for food stamps do not use them for whatever reason. Partly, one reason is the stigma. Another, apparently, is it takes two trips. You got to go out and get them, and so on. The elderly in particular don't use them. That's one of the reasons why our welfare reform proposal has proposed abolishing food stamps but incorporating the cash value of the food stamps into the level of the benefit. Because food stamps, there are 2 million people in the country as a whole, estimated, who are eligible for food stamps who aren't using them. So it's one of the reasons for consolidating the cash value of food stamps into the welfare program. That's one of those things that's under a lot of attack in Congress, though, the idea of getting rid of food stamps. For the wrong reason, I think. For the old bigoted reason that you got to give poor people food stamps because otherwise their kids won't get any food and they'll drink it all up. We have statistics now that have been developed that show that that's absolutely false. The poor spend a lot less of their money on alcohol and tobacco and so on, proportionally, than better off people do. I don't know what you do about people who are eligible for that kind of aid and don't come in. Actually, your personnel that are running those welfare offices are state personnel, not federal. So the money is part and part on most aspects of welfare. It's part federal and part state, but the personnel is all state. So. Yeah. Oh yeah. I don't know. Probably there's some people here that do know. Do you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, now you've earned the right to ask a question. I think there is going to be some disposition to add child care, more money for child care in the as the welfare bill goes through Congress, and that is not something the administration will fight, although you're correct, of course, in saying that except for the change in accounting and tax on child care, there was nothing explicit additional for child care in the welfare bill, but I have the feeling that adding some child care in the bill will not be fought. I don't see it at this time. I'm not sure I'm absolutely up to date. You came in late at the beginning. I announced that there were 381 statutorily mandated programs in HEW, and so far I made a list the other night and discovered I know a little teeny bit about 32 of them. So there are just a lot of things I don't know. Let me see if there's anybody else who has a first question before I take some second questions. Yes. Okay, let me take that in two bites, because the real problem with the Social Security Trust Fund is not the cost of Medicare, although they are heavy and heavier than was estimated at the time Medicare began. The real reason why the Social Security Trust Fund is right at the ragged edge of shaky condition, and we're going to get legislation to fix that, that's on its way. The real reason for the borderline unsound financial condition of the Social Security Trust Fund now is the fact that Congress legislated an automatic inflation increase in benefits, which most people agree is a good idea, right at the very time when we had our first inflationary recession in history, which put a double whammy on it. That benefits were automatically increasing because of that tremendous inflation, which you know hit 11% a year in 1975, at the same time that so many people were unemployed or working part-time that the normal amount of taxes wasn't coming in. So that's what really put Social Security in the shaky condition it's in. And there is legislation now. Different bills have gone through the House and the Senate, and the conference is probably going to agree on the final version sometime between here and the end of the year, and it'll be a decent bill. It is not clear yet quite how close it will be to what the administration proposed, but it will meet the bottom line objective, which is to put the Social Security Trust Fund back in sound financial condition through the end of almost the end of the century, which is as far as anybody can see anyway. As to your other the other part of your question about Medicare costs, the whole question of what you do about controlling escalating medical costs is a big piece of that. The hospital cost control legislation, I forget the numbers now, but it's somewhere in the neighborhood, I think, of Medicare and Medicaid combined. I don't know them separately. If we could get hold that hospital cost increase to 9%, as the bill would do, instead of 15%, I think the benefits, the non-drawdown of the non-expense, the state, federal and state government, because, of course, Medicaid is joint, is $800 million. Which cuts a big hole out of $1 billion. So just that simple, people don't realize $1 in every 12 that the federal government spend goes for health care. It's just absolutely out of control. And something's got to be done about it. And the hospital cost control bill is the first step. Then whatever comes on national health insurance will also make a difference. But, of course, none of the basic decisions have been made on that yet. None of those decisions have been made, not even close. Right now, there's just no way I can speculate or try to answer that question. Yes. Sure does. Well, a special team has been put together inside of HEW. Cutting across several elements of the department, the health side, the planning side, and so on, which will be working together to devise a program. The Undersecretary Hale Champion will be a key person, and of course the final recommendation that we make to the White House, the Secretary Califano will personally have a big hand in, and then ultimately, of course, the decision will be the President's. It will be a major presidential legislative proposal. Probably, our current guess is around the middle of next year. I'm not very close to the Congress anymore. I don't, so that you'd do much better to ask a political person who's up there all the time. My basic feeling is that one of the serious problems is that the anti-abortion people are seen, I think perhaps accurately, as one-issue people, the kind of people who will vote against you and kill you if you don't vote their way, whereas most pro-abortion people are not one-issue people. I had a little chat with Karen Mulhauser, the head of NARAL over in the exhibit hall last night, and that was her view, too, that the pro-abortion people are, by and large, not one-issue people, and therefore members of Congress just aren't as scared. But more lobbying obviously couldn't hurt. Was there? Yes. Yes. There is a proposal now that I can't give you a lot of the details of because it has gone forward to OMB for fiscal 79, a multifaceted attack on teenage pregnancy involving both prevention and taking care of the girls to go ahead and have their babies, which is a lot. You know, even last year when abortions, including for poor women, were readily available, of the 1 million teenagers who got married, who got pregnant. I was trying to remember how many got married. I think it was 600,000 unmarried ones went ahead and had their babies, despite the existence of available abortion. So that the business of better services to take care of the girl who has her baby, and hopefully, one of the things I discover people don't understand very well, not this group will understand it, but a lot of the policymakers in Congress and elsewhere don't understand, is that presenting the second, third, fourth, and fifth pregnancy is important too. In fact, I remember right after I came into office talking to a group from NARAL, including some people who were running abortion clinics in several different cities, who told me that the most typical seeker of an abortion was a youngish woman pregnant for the second time who had had a baby and was just getting back up on her feet again when she turned up pregnant again and said, oh, no, I just can't cope. So that an awful lot of, there's been a little press coverage that has indicated that anything other than prevention is a cop-out. I don't take that view at all for those reasons, that reaching the young woman who has her baby with the information that will encourage her not to get pregnant again. The very young women, more than a third of them are pregnant again within 18 months, the ones who are under 18. And so, and there's going to be money. It's a very substantial program of, as I say, both prevention and post-pregnancy aid. You had a question. Huh? I don't know. I think I'm not a good person to ask that question. You can, of course, there's some people who'd like to volunteer who are more politically experienced in the field. Go ahead. Great. Are there some more questions? Yeah, oh yeah, there's 3:30. Right? Good job. Well, what do I know the answer to that question? I suppose the thing that surprised me the most since I came into HEW, I didn't even mention it at all, because I don't know how to deal with it. It's the unholy alliance between the career bureaucrats of the executive branch and what you might call the career bureaucrats of the legislative branch, both hell-bent upon keeping the constitutionally elected and appointed officials from carrying out their policies. And I see four or five of my colleagues newly in the government, who all of whom relate to that. That's hard to do. And if I have a few deep knife wounds between my third and fourth ribs, which I do, it is from precisely such fights, which are bloody. They engaged in the career of they, some people in the administration on aging and their buddies in Congress who have been just allowed to go ahead and do anything they want to do under the years of non-management. campaign of personal vilification against me, which I'm happy to tell you, by the way, I became aware of when two women I had never met, one in Chicago and one in Kentucky, both of whom had put in grant proposals under this thing I was trying to stop because it was so inflated and hadn't been properly cleared. Two different women called me up and said, listen, you ought to know what they're saying about you, and they're saying they're going to get you, and they're sending out letters about this power-mad woman who is trying to do these things and so on. And it was a timely alert that enabled me to move effectively that I wouldn't have been able to do if I hadn't gotten that warning. It's very, very serious. And we're all experiencing it, and I think it's going to take a high order of both management and political skills on our part. Arabella Martinez, another assistant secretary in HEW, is having a very serious problem with really being vilified by a congressional staff person who was used to really running the programs she's supposed to run from his congressional office. Those are hard questions, but there again, as in some of the other things I mentioned, I'm hopeful that maybe it's Democrats who will be able to deal with that. And especially when it's the Democratic Congress as well, and the fact that we're the same party doesn't help much, but it's better than being the opposite party, I think, in terms of trying to resolve those problems. That's the real question. It's a toughie. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yeah.